This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Chapter 16 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 16. For many years, nothing had given Mr. Alwyn such heartfelt pleasure as the news Ruth had to tell him as he drove her back next morning to Slumberley behind Mrs. Alwyn's long-tailed ponies. It was a still September morning with a faint pearl sky and half-veiled silver sun. Pale gleams of sunshine wandered across the busy harvest fields and burnished the steel of the river. Decisions of any kind rarely look their best after a sleepless night, but as Ruth saw the expression of happiness and relief that came into her uncle's face when she told him what had happened, she felt again that she was glad, very glad. "Oh, my dear, my dear!" Mr. Alwyn was driving the ponies first against the bank and then into the opposite ditch. "How glad I am! How thankful! I had almost hoped, certainly. I wish so much to think it possible, but then one can never tell. Poor dear, poor fellow, I used to be so sorry for him. And how much he will be able to do at Vanden among the people. It will be a different place, and it is such a relief to think that the poor old house will be looked after. It went to my heart to see the way it had been neglected. I ventured this morning, as I was down early, to move some of that dear old Worcester farther back into the cabinet. They really were so near the edge. I could not bear to see them, and I found a savour of saucer, my dear, in the library that belonged to one of those beautiful cups in the drawing-room. I hope it was not very wrong, but I had to put it among its relations. It was sitting with a Delft mug on it, poor thing. Dear me, I little thought then. Really, I'd never been so glad about anything before." After a little more conversation, and after Mr. Alwyn had been persuaded to give the reins to his niece, who was far more composed than himself, his mind reverted to his wife. "I think, my dear, until your engagement is more settled, till I've had a talk with Dare on the subject, which will be necessary before you write to your Uncle Francis, it would be as well not to refer to it before, in fact, not to mention it to Mrs. Alwyn. Your dear aunt's warm heart and conversational bent makes it almost impossible for her to refrain from speaking of anything that interests her. And indeed, even if she does not say anything in so many words, I have observed that opinions are sometimes formed by others as to the subject on which she is silent, by her manner when any chance allusion is made to it." Ruth heartily agreed. She had been dreading this searching catechism through which Mrs. Alwyn would certainly put her, the minute inquiries as to her dress, the hour, the place, whether it had been standing up or sitting down, all her questions, of course, interwoven with personal reminiscences of how John had done it and her own emotion at the time. It was with no small degree of relief at the postponement of that evil hour that Ruth entered the house. As she did so, a faint sound reached her ear. It was that of a musical box. "Dear, dear," said Mr. Alwyn, as he followed her, "it is a fine day. Your aunt must be ill." For the moment, Ruth did not understand the connection of ideas in his mind, until she suddenly remembered the musical box, which Mrs. Alwyn had often told her was so nice and cheery on a wet day or in times of illness. She hurriedly entered the drawing-room, followed by Mr. Alwyn, where the first object that met her view was Mrs. Alwyn extended on the sofa, arrayed in what she called her tea-gown, a loose robe of blue cretonne, with a large vine-leaf pattern twining over it, which broke out into grapes at intervals. Ruth knew the garment well. It came on only when Mrs. Alwyn was suffering. She had worn it last during a period of entire mental prostration, which had succeeded all too soon an exciting discovery of mushrooms in the glebe. Mr. Alwyn's heart and Ruth's sank as they caught sight of it again. With a dignity befitting the occasion, Mrs. Alwyn recounted in detail the various ways in which she had employed herself after their departure the previous evening, up to the exact moment when she slipped going upstairs and sprained her ankle, in a blue and green manner that had quite alarmed the doctor when he had seen it, and compared with which Mrs. Thursby's gathered finger in the spring was a mere bagatelle. "Mrs. Thursby stayed in bed when her finger was bad," said Mrs. Alwyn to Ruth, when Mr. Alwyn had condoled and had made his escape to his study. She always gives way so, but I never was like that. I was up all the same, my dear." "I hope it does not hurt very much," said Ruth, anxious to be sympathetic, but succeeding only in being commonplace. "It's not only the pain," said Mrs. Alwyn, in the gentle, resigned voice which she always used when indisposed, the voice of one at peace with all the world, and ready to depart from a scene consequently so devoid of interest. "But to a person of my habits, Ruth, never a day without going into the larder, and always seeing after the servants as I do, first one duty, and then another, and the chickens, and all, seems a strange thing that I should be laid aside." Mrs. Alwyn paused, as if she had not for the nonce fathomed the ulterior reasons for this special move on the part of Providence, which had crippled her, while it left room for Mrs. Thursby with the use of their limbs. "However," she continued, "I am not one to repine. Always cheery and busy, Ruth, that is my motto. And now, my dear, if you will wind up the musical box, and then read me a little bit out of Texts with Tender Twinings," the new floral manual which had lately superseded the Pearls, "after that we will start on one of my scrapbooks, and you should tell me all about your visit to Vanden." It was not the time Ruth would have chosen for a tete-a-tete with her aunt. She was longing to be alone, to think quietly over what had happened, and it was difficult to concentrate her attention on pink and yellow calico, and cut out coloured royal families and foreign birds with a good grace. Happily Mrs. Alwyn, though always requiring attention, was quite content with the half of what she required, and with the Buffalo Girls and the Danube River tinkling on the table, conversation was somewhat superfluous. In the afternoon Dare came, but he was waylaid in the hall by Mr. Alwyn and taken into the study before he could commit himself in Mrs. Alwyn's presence. Mrs. Thursby and Mabel also called to condole, and a little later Mrs. Smith of Greenacre, who had heard the news of the accident from the doctor. Altogether it was a delightful afternoon for Mrs. Alwyn, who assumed for the time an air of superiority over Mrs. Thursby, to which that lady's well-known chronic ill-health seldom allowed her to lay claim. Mrs. Alwyn and Mrs. Thursby had remained friends since they both arrived together as brides at Slumberley, in spite of a difference of opinion which had at one time strained friendly relations to a painful degree, as to the propriety of wearing the hair over the top of the ear. The hair question settled, a temporary difficulty, extending over a few years, had sprung up at its place, respecting what Mrs. Thursby called family. Mrs. Alwyn's family was not her strong point, nor was its position strengthened by her assertion, unsupported by Mrs. Markham, that she was directly descended from Queen Elizabeth. Consequently, it was trying to Mrs. Thursby, who, as everyone knows, was one of the brainless Copleys of Copley, that Mrs. Alwyn, who in the lottery of marriage had drawn an honourable, should take precedence of herself. To obviate this difficulty, Mrs. Thursby, with the ingenuity of her sex, had at one time introduced Mr. and Mrs. Alwyn as our rector and our rector's wife, thus denying them their names altogether, for fear lest their connection with Lord Polesworth should be remembered, and the fact that Mr. Alwyn was his brother, and consequently an honourable, should transpire. This peculiarity of etiquette entirely escaped Mr. Alwyn, but aroused feelings in the breast of his wife which might have brought about one of those deeply rooted feuds which so often exist between the squires' and clergymen's families, if it had not been for the timely and serious illness in which Mrs. Thursby lost her health, and, the principal part of the other subject of disagreement, her hair. Then Queen Elizabeth and the Honourable were alike forgotten. With her own hands Mrs. Alwyn made a certain jelly, which Mrs. Thursby praised in the highest manner, saying she only wished it had been the habit in her family to learn to do anything so useful. Mrs. Thursby's new gowns were no longer kept a secret from Mrs. Alwyn, to be suddenly sprung upon her at a garden party, when, possibly in an old garment herself, she was least able to bear the shock. Bygones were bygones, and greatly to the relief of the two husbands, their respective wives made up their differences. "And a very pleasant afternoon it has been," said Mrs. Alwyn, when the Thursbys and Dare, who had been loath to go, had taken their departure. "Mrs. Thursby and Mabel, and Mrs. Smith, and Mr. Dare, four to tea. Quite a little party, wasn't it, Ruth? And so informal and nice, and the buns came in as naturally as possible, which no one heard me whisper to James for. I think those little citron buns are nicer than a great cake like Mrs. Thursby's, and hers are always so black and overbaked. That is why the cook sifts such a lot of sugar over them. I do think one should be real, and not try to cover up things. And Mr. Dare's so pleasant. Quite sorry to go, he seemed. I often wonder whether it were you or Mabel in the end. He ought to be making up his mind. I expect I shall have a little joke with him about it before long. And such an interest he took in the scrapbook. I asked him to come again tomorrow.
I don't expect he will be able to do so, said Mr. Owen. I rather think he will have to go to town on business.
Later in the evening, Mr. Owen told Ruth that in the course of his interview he found that Dare had the very vaguest ideas as to the necessity of settlements, had evidently never given the subject a thought, and did not even know what he actually possessed. Mr. Owen was secretly afraid of what Ruth's trustee, his brother, Lord Polesworth, now absent shooting in the Rocky Mountains, would say if, during his absence, their niece was allowed to engage herself without suitable provision. And he begged Ruth not to do anything rash in the way of speaking of her engagement, until Dare could, with the help of his lawyer, see his way to making some arrangement.
"I know he has no money," said Ruth quietly. "That is one of the reasons why I am going to marry him."
Mr. Alwyn, to whom this seemed the most natural reason in the world, was not sure whether it would strike his brother with equal force. He had a suspicion that when Lord Polesworth's attention should be turned from white goats and brown bears to the fact that his niece, who had means of her own, had been allowed to engage herself to a poor man, and that Mr. Alwyn had greatly encouraged the match, unpleasant questions might be asked.
"Francis will be back in November," said Mr. Alwyn. "I think, Ruth, we'd better wait till his return before we do anything definite."
"Anything more definite, you mean?" said Ruth. "I have been very definite already, I think. I shall be glad to wait until he comes back, if you wish it, Uncle John. I shall try to do what you both advise. But at the same time, I am of age, and if my word is worth anything, you know I have given that already."
Dare felt no call to go to London by the early train on the following morning, so he found himself at liberty to spend an hour at Slumberley Rectory on his way to the station, and by the advice of Mr. Alwyn went into the garden, where the sound of the musical box reached the ear but in faint echoes, and where Ruth presently joined him. In his heart, Dare was secretly afraid of Ruth, though, as he often told himself, it was more than probable she was equally afraid of him. If that were so, she controlled her feelings wonderfully, for as she came to meet him, nothing could have been more frankly kind, more friendly, or more composed than her manner towards him. He took her outstretched hand and kissed it. It was not quite the way in which he had pictured to himself that they would meet, but if his imagination had taken somewhat bolder flight in her absence, he felt now, as she stood before him, that it had taken that flight in vain. He kept her hand and looked intently at her. She did not change colour, nor did that disappointing friendliness leave her steady eyes. "She does not love me," he said to himself. "It is strange, but she does not. But the day will come." "You are going to London, are you not?" asked Ruth, withdrawing her hand at last. And after hearing a detailed account of his difficulties and anxieties about money matters, and after taking an immense weight off his mind by telling him that they would have no influence in causing her to alter her decision, she sent him beaming and rejoicing on his way, quite a different person to the victim of anxiety and depression who had arrived at Slumberley an hour before. Mrs. Alwyn was much annoyed at Dare's entire want of heart in leaving the house without coming to see her, and during the remainder of the morning she did not cease to comment on the differences that exist between what people really are and what they seem to be, until, in her satisfaction at recounting the accident to Evelyn Danvers, a new and sympathetic listener, she fortunately forgot the slight put upon her ankle earlier in the day. The complete enjoyment of her sufferings was, however, destined to sustain a severe shock the following morning. She and Ruth were reading their letters, Mrs. Alwyn, of course, giving Ruth the benefit of the various statements respecting the weather which her correspondents had confided to her, when Mr. Alwyn came in from the study, an open letter in his hand. He was quite pink with pleasure. "He has asked me to go and see them," he said, "and they are small and have green seals, all excepting one," referring to the letter, "which has a big red seal in a tin box attached by a tape. Ruth, I am perfectly convinced beforehand that those charters are grants of land of the 14th or 15th century. Sir Charles mentions that they are in black letter and only a few lines on each, but he says he won't describe them in full, as I must come and see them for myself. Dear me, how I shall enjoy arranging them for him, which he asked me to do. I had really become so anxious about them that a few days ago I determined to set my mind at rest, and I wrote to him to ask for particulars, and that is his answer."
Mr. Alwyn put Charles' letter into her hand, and she glanced over it.
"Why, Uncle John, he asks Aunt Fanny as well, and if Miss Dancourt is still with you, pleasure, etc., and me, too."
"When is it for?"
asked Mrs. Alwyn, suddenly sitting bolt upright. "Let me see. Black letter size about... where is it? Here. Tuesday the 25th for 3 nights. Leaving home following week for some time. Excuse short notice, etc. It's next week, Aunt Fanny."
"I shall not be able to go,"
gasped Mrs. Alwyn, sinking back on her sofa, while something very like tears came into her eyes.
"And I've never been there, Ruth. The Thursbys went once, in old Sir George's time, and Mrs. Thursby always says this is the show place in the county, and that it is such a pity I have not seen it. And last autumn, when John went, I was in Devonshire, and never even heard of his going till I got home, or I'd have come back. Oh, Ruth, oh dear!"
Mrs. Alwyn let her letters fall into her lap, and drew forth the coloured pocket handkerchief which she wore, in imitation of Mabel Thursby, stuck into the bodice of her gown, and at the ominous appearance of which Mr. Alwyn suddenly recollected a duty in the study, and retreated. With an unerring instinct, Ruth flew to the musical box and set it going, and then knelt down by the prostrate figure of her aunt, and administered what sympathy and consolation she could to the cheery accompaniment of the Buffalo Girls.
"Never mind, dear Aunt Fanny. Perhaps he will ask you again when you are better. There will be other opportunities."
"I always was unlucky," said Mrs. Alwyn faintly. "I had a swelled face up the Rhine on our honeymoon. Things always happen like that with me. At any rate," after a pause, "there is one thing. We ought to try and look at the bright side. It is not as though we have not been asked. We have not been overlooked."
"No," said Ruth promptly, and in her own mind she registered a vow that in her future home she would never give the pain that being overlooked by the larger house can cause to the smaller house.
"And I will stay with you, Aunt Fanny," she went on cheerfully. "Uncle John can go by himself, and we will do just what we like while he is away, won't we?"
But at this Mrs. Alwyn demurred. She was determined that if she played the role of a martyr, she would do it well. She insisted that Ruth should accompany Mr. Alwyn. She secretly looked forward to telling Mabel that Ruth was going. She did not mind being left alone, she said. She desired, with a sigh of self-sacrifice, that Mr. Alwyn should accept for himself and his niece. She had not been brought up to consider herself, thank God. She had her faults, she knew. No one was more fully aware of them than herself. But she was not going to prevent others enjoying themselves because she herself was laid aside. "And now, my dear," she said, with a sudden return to mundane interests that succeeded, rather unexpectedly, to the celestial spirit of her previous remarks, "you must be thinking about your gowns. If I had been going, I should have had my ruby satin done up, so beautiful by candlelight. What have you to wear? That white lace tea-gown with the silver-grey train is very nice, but you ought not to be in half-mourning now. I like to see young people in colours. And then there is that golden-white brocade, Ruth, that you wore at the drawing-room last year. It is a beautiful dress, but rather too quiet. Could not you brighten it up with a few cherry-coloured bows about it, or a sash? I always think a sash is so becoming. If you were to bring it down, I dare say I could suggest something. And you must be well dressed, for though he only said friends, you can never tell whom you may not meet at a place like that."
End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 17. The last week of September found Charles back at Stoke Moreton to receive the friends of whom Mrs. Alwyn spoke. People whose partridges he had helped to kill were now to be gathered from the east and from the west to help to kill his. From the north also guests were coming, were leaving their mountains to, but the remainder of the line is invidious. The Hope Actons had written to offer a visit at Stoke Moreton on the strength of an old promise to Charles, a promise so old that he had forgotten it until reminded that next time they were passing they would take his house on their way. They had offered their visit exactly at the same time for which he had just invited the Alwyns and Ruth. Charles felt that they were not quite the people whom he would have arranged to meet each other, but as fate had so decreed it, he acquiesced calmly enough. But when Lady Mary also wrote tenderly from Scarborough to ask if she could be of any use helping to entertain his guests, he felt it imperative to draw the line, and wrote a grateful effusion to his aunt, saying that he could not think of asking her to leave a place where he felt sure she was deriving spiritual and temporal benefit, in order to assist at so unprofitable a festivity as a shooting party. He mentioned casually that Lady Grace Lawrence, Miss Daincourt, and Miss Wyndham were to be at the party, which details he imagined might have an interest for her amid her graver reflections. The subject of Ruth's coming certainly had a prominent place in his own graver reflections. For the last fortnight, as he went from house to house, he had been wondering how he could meet her again, and when Mr. Alwyn's letter concerning the charters was forwarded to him, a sudden inspiration made him then and there send the invitation which had arrived at Slumberley Rectory a few days before. He groaned in spirit as he wrote it, at the thought of Mrs. Alwyn disporting herself, dressed in the brightest colours, among his other guests, and it was with a feeling of thankfulness that he found Ruth and Mr. Alwyn were coming without her. He had felt very little interest so far in the party, which, with the exception of the Hope Actons, had been long arranged, but now he found himself looking forward to it with actual impatience, and he returned home a day before the time, instead of an hour or two before his guests were expected, as was his wont. The Wyndhams and Hope Actons, with Lady Grace in tow, were the first to appear upon the scene. Mr. Alwyn and Ruth arrived a few hours later, amid a dropping fire of young men and gun-cases, who kept on turning up at intervals during the afternoon, and, according to the mysterious nocturnal habits of their kind, till late into the night. If ever a man appears to advantage, it is on his native hearth, and as Charles stood on his in the long hall, where it was the habit of the house to assemble before dinner, Ruth found that her attempts at conversation were rather thrown away upon Lady Grace, with whom she had been renewing an old acquaintance, and whose interest, for the time being, entirely centred in the carved coats of arms and heraldic designs with which the towering white stone chimney-piece was covered. Lady Grace was one of those pretty, delicate creatures who remind one of a very elaborate rosebud. There was an appearance of ultra-refinement about her, a look of that refinement which is in itself a weakness, a poverty of blood, so to speak, the opposite and more pleasing but equally unhealthy extreme of coarseness. She looked very pretty, as, having left Ruth, she stood by Charles, passing a little pink hand over the lowest carvings, dim and warm with the heat of many generations of fires, and listened with rapt attention to his answers to her questions.
"And the hall is so beautiful,"
she said, looking round with childlike curiosity at the walls covered with weapons, with a long array of armour, and at the massive pillars of carved white stone which rose up out of the polished floor to meet the raftered ceiling.
"It is so, so uncommon."
Whatever Charles's other failings may have been, he was an admirable host. The weather was fine. What can be finer than September when she's in a good humour? The two first days of Ruth's visit were unalloyed enjoyment. It seemed like a sudden return to the old life with Lady Daincourt, when the round of country visits regularly succeeded the season in London. Of Mr. Alwyn she saw little or nothing. He was buried in the newly discovered charters. Of Charles she saw a good deal, more than at the time she was quite aware of, for he seemed to see a great deal of everybody, from Lady Grace to the shy man of the party, who at Stoke Moreton first conceived the idea that he was an acquisition to society. But whether Charles made the opportunities or not which came so readily to his hand, still he found time, amid the pressure of his shooting arrangements and his duties as host, to talk to Ruth. One day there was cub-hunting in the grey of the early morning, to which she and Miss Wyndham went with Charles and others of the party who could bear to get up betimes. Losing sight of the others after a time, Ruth and Charles rode back alone together, when the sun was high, walking their tired horses along the blackberried lanes and down the long green rides cut in the yellowing bracken of the park. "And so you are going to winter in Rome?" said Charles, who had the previous day, contrary to his wont, accepted an invitation to Slumberley Hall for the middle of October. "I sometimes go to Rome for a few weeks when the shooting is over. And are you glad or sorry at the prospect of leaving your Cranford?"
"Very sorry."
"Why?"
"I have seen an entirely new phase of life at Slumberley."
"I think I can guess what you mean," said Charles gravely. "One does not often meet anyone like Mr. Alwyn."
"No, I was thinking of him. Until I came to Slumberley the lines had not fallen to me in very clerical places, so my experience is limited. But he seems to me the only clergyman I have known who does not force on one a form of religion that has been dead and buried for years."
"The clergy have much to answer for on that head," said Charles with bitterness. I sometimes like and respect them as individuals, but I do not love them as a class. One ought to make allowance for the fact that they are tied and bound by the chain of their 39 articles, that at 23 they shut the doors deliberately on any new and possibly unorthodox idea, and it is consequently unreasonable to expect from them any genuine freedom or originality of thought. I can forgive them their assumption of superiority, their inability to meet honest scepticism with anything like fairness, their continual bickering among themselves, but I cannot forgive them the harm they are doing to religion, the discredit that they bring upon it by their bigoted views and obsolete ideas. They busy themselves doing good. That's the worst of it. They mean well, but they do not see that, in the meanwhile, their church is being left unto them desolate. Though perhaps, after all, the church having come to be what it is, that is the best thing that can happen.
There are men among the clergy who will not come under that sweeping accusation, said Ruth. Look at some of the London churches. Are they desolate? Goodness and earnestness will be a power to the end of time, however narrow the accompanying creed may be.
That is true, but we have heads as well as hearts. Goodness and earnestness appeal to the heart alone. The intellect is left out in the cold. However good and earnest and eloquent one of these great preachers may be, the reason we go to hear him is not only because of that, because he appears to be thinking in a straight line, because he seems to recognize the long-resisted claim of the intellect, and we hope you'll have a word to say to us. He promises well, but listen to him a little longer, follow his thought, and you'll begin to see that he will only look for truth within a certain area, that his steps are describing an arc, that he is tethered. Give him time enough, and you will see him tread out the complete circle in which he and his brethren are equally bound to walk.
You forget, said Ruth, that you are regarding the church from the standpoint of the cultivated and intellectual class, for whom the church has ceased to represent religion. But there are lots of people neither cultivated nor intellectual, women even of our own class are not so as a rule, to whom the church, with its ritual and dogma, is a real help and comfort. If, as you say, it does not suit the more highly educated, I think you have no right to demand that it should suit what is, after all, a very small minority. It would be most unfair if it did.
Charles did not answer. He had been looking at her, and thinking how few women could have disagreed with him as quietly and resolutely as this young girl riding at his side, carefully avoiding chance rabbit holes as she spoke.
There is, and there always will be, a certain number of people, not only among the clergy, she went on, who, as somebody says, put the church clock back, and are unable to see that they cannot alter the time of day for all that. Only they can and do prevent many well-intentioned people from trusting to it any longer. But there are others, here and there, whom a dogmatic form of religion has been quite unable to spoil, whose more simple turn of mind draws out of the very system that appears to you so lifeless an effete, a real faith, a personal possession, which no one can take from them.
Her eyes sparkled as she spoke, and Charles saw that she was thinking of Mr. Alwyn. He has got it, he said slowly, this something which we all want, and for the greater part never find. He has got it. To see and recognize it early is a great thing, he continued earnestly. To disbelieve in it in early life, and cavil at all the caricatures and imitations, and only come to find out its reality comparatively later on, is a great misfortune, a great misfortune. She felt that he was speaking of himself, and they rode on in silence, each grave with a sense of mutual understanding and companionship. They forded the stream and trotted up the little village street, the cottagers gazing admiringly after them, till they disappeared within the great arched gateway. And Charles looked at his old house as they paced up the wide drive, and wondered whether it were indeed possible that the lonely years he had spent in it had come to an end at last. At last. Ruth had noticed that he had lost no opportunity of talking to her, and when she heard him conversing with Lady Grace, or plunging into fashionable slang with Miss Wyndham, found herself admiring the facility with which he adapted himself to different people. The following afternoon, as she was writing in the library, she was amused to see that he found it incumbent on him to write too, even going so far as to produce a letter from Molly, whose correspondence, he said, he invariably answered by return. "You seem very fond of giving Molly pleasure," said Ruth. "'I am glad to see, Miss Dainkorf, that you are beginning to estimate me at my true worth.'
"'You have it in your power just now to give a great pleasure,' said Ruth earnestly, laying down the pen which he had taken up.
"'How?'
"'It seems so absurd when it is put into words, but by asking Mrs. Albin sometime to stay here. She has always longed to see Stoke Moreton because Mrs. Thursby has. A real, positive, actual tears were shed that she could not come when you asked us.'
"'Is it possible?' said Charles. "'It's the first time that any letter of mine has caused emotion of that description.'
"'You don't know how important the smallest thing appears if one lives in a little corner of the world where nothing ever happens. If Mrs. Albin had been able to come, her visit would have been an event which she would have remembered for years. I assure you, I myself, from having lived at Slumberley 8 months, became quite excited at the prospect of so much dissipation.'
And Ruth leaned back in her chair with a little laugh. Charles looked narrowly at her, and his face fell. "'I'm so glad you told me,' he said after a moment's pause. "'People generally mention these things about 10 years afterwards, when there is probably no possibility of doing anything. Thank you.'
Ruth was disconcerted by the sudden gravity of his tone, and almost regretted the impulse that had made her speak. She forgot it, however, in the tableau vivant which they were preparing for the evening, in which she and Charles illustrated the symbol nun to enthusiastic applause. Ruth represented the nun engaged in conversation over the lowest imaginable convent wall, with Charles in all the glory of his cocked hat and deputy lieutenant's uniform, who, while he held the nun's hand in one of his, pointed persuasively with the other towards an elaborately caparisoned war-horse, trembling beneath the joint weight of a yeomanry saddle and a side saddle attached behind it, which considerably overlapped the charger's impromptu fur boa tail. After the tableau there was dancing in acting costume, at which the two men, who acted the war-horse between them, were the only persons to protest, Lady Grace being beautiful as an improvised Anne Boleyn, and the shy man resplendent in a fancy dress of Charles's. When the third morning came, Ruth gave a genuine sigh at the thought that it was the last day. Lady Grace, who was also leaving the following morning, may be presumed to have echoed it with far more sorrow. The Wyndhams were going that day, and disappeared down the drive, waving handkerchiefs and carriage rugs and hats on sticks out of the carriage windows, as is the custom of really amusing people when taking leave. In the afternoon, Lady Grace and Charles went off for a ride alone together, to see some ruin in which Lady Grace had manifested a sudden interest. The third horse, which had been brought round for another of the men, being sent back to the stables, his destined rider having decided, at the 11th hour, to join the rest of the party in a little desultory rabbit-shooting in the park, which he proceeded to do with much chuckling over his extraordinary penetration and tact. The elder ladies went out driving, looking, as seen from an upper window, like four poached eggs on a dish, and the coast being clear, Ruth, who had no love of driving, escaped with her paint-box to the garden, where she was making a sketch of Stoke Moreton. Some houses, like people, have dignity. Stoke Moreton, with ivy creeping up its mellow sandstone and peeping into its long lines of mullioned windows, stood solemn and stately amid its level gardens. The low sun, bringing out every line of carved stone frieze and quaint architrave, firing all the western windows and touching the tall heads of the hollyhocks and sunflowers, that stood in ordered regiments within their high walls of clipped box. And Ruth dabbed and looked, and dabbed again, until she suddenly found that if she put another stroke she would spoil all, and also that her hands were stiff with cold. After a few admiring glances at her work, she set off on a desultory journey round the garden to get warm, and finally, seeing an oak door in the garden wall open, wandered through it into the churchyard. The church door was open too, and Ruth, after reading some of the epitaphs on the tombstones, went in. It was a common little church enough, with a large mortuary chapel, where all the Danvers family reposed, ancient Danvers lying in armour, with their mailed hands joined beside their wives, more modern Danvers kneeling in bas-relief in coloured plaster and execrable taste in recesses. The last generations were there also, some of them anticipating the resurrection and feathered wings, but for the most part still asleep. Charles's mother was there, lying in white marble among her husband's people,
with the child upon her arm, which she had taken away with her. And in the midst of the chapel was the last Sir Charles Danvers, whom his brother, Sir George, the father of the present owner, had succeeded. The evening sun shone full on the kneeling soldier figure, leaning on its sword, and on the grave, clear-cut face, which had a look of Charles. The long, beautifully modelled hands, clasped over the battered steel sword-hilt, were like Charles's too. Ruth read the inscription on the low marble pedestal, relating how he had fallen in the taking of the Redan, and then looked again. And gradually a great feeling of pity rose in her heart for the family which had lived here for so many generations, and which seemed now so likely to die out. Providence does not seem to care much for old families, or to value long descent. Rather, it seems to favour the new race, the Browns, and the Joneses, and the Robinsons, who yesterday were not, and who today elbow the old county families from the place which has known them from time immemorial. "I suppose Molly will some day marry a Smith," said Ruth to herself, "and then it will all be over. I don't think I would come and see her here when she is married." With which reflection she returned to the house, and after disturbing Mr. Albin, who was deep in a catalogue of the Danvers manuscripts, in which it was his firm conviction that he should find some mention of the charters, she went into the library, and wondered which of the several thousands of books would interest her till the others came in. The library was a large room, the walls of which were lined with books from the floor to the ceiling. In order to place the higher shelves within reach, a light balcony of polished oak ran round the four walls, about equidistant from the floor and the ceiling. Ruth went up the tiny corkscrew staircase in the wall, which led to the balcony, and setting herself comfortably in the low, wide window-seat, took out one volume after another of those that came within her reach. These shelves by the window where she was sitting had somehow a different look to the rest. Old books and new, white vellum and cardboard, were herded together without any apparent order, and with no respect of bindings. Here a splendid Morocco, Novum Organum, was pushed in beside a cheap and much-worn edition of Marcus Aurelius. There Emerson and Plato and Shakespeare jostled each other on the same shelf, while just below, Don Quixote was pressed into the uncongenial society of Carlyle on one side and Confucius on the other. As she pulled out one book after another, she noticed that the greater part of them had Charles's name in them. Ruth's curiosity was at once aroused. No doubt this was the little corner in his great house in which he chose to read, and these were his favourite books which he had arranged so close to his hand. If we can judge our fellow creatures at all, which is doubtful, it is by the books they read, and by those which, having read, they read again. She looked at the various volumes in the window seat beside her with new interest, and opened the first one she took up. It was a collection of translations from the Persian poets, gentlemen of the name of Shemshid, Sa'di, and Hafiz, of whom she had never heard. As she turned over the pages, she heard the ringing of horses' hoofs, and looking out from her point of observation, saw Charles and Lady Grace cantering up the short, wide approach, and clattering out of sight again behind the great stone archway. She turned back to her book, and was reading an ode here and there, wondering to see how the same thoughts that worked within us today had lived with man so many hundred years ago, when her eye was caught by some writing on the margin of a page as she turned it over. A single sentence on the page was strongly underlined. "True self-knowledge is knowledge of God." Jemshid was a wise man, Ruth thought, if he had found out that. And then she read in Charles's clear handwriting in the margin, "With this compare, look within. Within us is the fountain of good, and it will ever bubble up if thou will ever dig. Marcus Aurelius." At this moment Charles came into the library, and looked up to where she was sitting, half hidden from below by the thickness of the wall. "What, studying?" he called gaily. "I saw you sitting in the window as I rode up. I might have known that if you were lost sight of for half an hour, you would be found improving yourself in some exasperating way." And he ran up the little stairs and came round the balcony towards her. "My own special books, I see. Eve, as usual, surreptitiously craving for a knowledge of good and evil. What have you got hold of?" The remainder of the window seat was full of books, so to obtain a better view of what she was reading, he knelt down by her, and looked at the open book on her knee. Ruth did not attempt to close it. She felt guilty, she hardly knew of what. After a moment's pause, she said, "I plead guilty. I was curious. I saw these be your own particular shelves, but I never can resist looking at the books people read. Will you be pleased to remember in future that, in contemplating my character, Miss Dancourt, a subject not unworthy of your attention, you are on private property? You are requested to keep on the gravel paths and to look at the grounds I am disposed to show you. If, as is very possible, admiration seizes you, you are at liberty to express it. But there must be no going round to the back premises, no prying into corners, no trespassing where I have written up, no road." Ruth smiled, and there was a gleam in her eyes which Charles well knew heralded a retort, when suddenly, through the half-open door, a silken rustle came, and Lady Hope Acton slowly entered the room, as if about to pass through it on her way to the hall. Now, kneeling is by no means an attitude to be despised. In church, or the moment of presentation to Majesty, it is appropriate, even essential, but it is dependent, like most things, upon circumstances and environment. No attitude, for instance, could be more suitable and natural to anyone wishing to read the page on which a sitting fellow creature was engaged. Charles had found it so. But, as Lady Hope Acton sailed into the room, he felt that, however conducive to study, it was not the attitude in which he would at that moment have chosen to be found. Ruth felt the same. It had seemed so natural a moment before. It was so hideously suggestive now. Perhaps Lady Hope Acton would pass on through the other door, so widely, so invitingly open. Neither stirred in the hope that she might do so. But in the centre of the room she stopped and sighed, the slow, crackling sigh of a stout woman in a too well-fitting silk gown. Charles suddenly felt as if his muddy boots and cords were trying to catch her eye, as if every book on the shelves were calling to her to look up. For a second Ruth and Charles gazed down upon the top of Lady Hope Acton's head, the bald place on which showed dimly through her semi-transparent cap. She moved slightly, as if to go. But no, another step was drawing near. In another moment Lady Grace came in through the opposite door, in her riding habit. Ruth felt that it was now or never for a warning cough, but as she glanced at Charles kneeling beside her, she could not give it. Surely they would pass out in another second. The thought of the two pairs of eyes which would be raised, and the expression in them, was intolerable. "Grace," said Lady Hope Acton, with dreadful distinctness, advancing to meet her daughter, "has he spoken?"
"No,"
said Lady Grace, with a little sob.
"And,"
with a sudden burst of tears,
"oh, mamma, I don't think he ever will."
Oh, to have coughed, to have sneezed, to have choked a moment earlier. Anything would have been better than this. "Run upstairs this moment, then, and change your habit and bathe your eyes," said Lady Hope Acton sharply. "You need not come down till dinner-time. I say you are tired." And then, to the overwhelming relief of those two miserable spectators, the mother and daughter left the door. But to the momentary sensation of relief in Ruth's mind, a rush of pity succeeded for the childlike grief and tears, and with and behind it, like one hurrying wave overtopping and bearing down its predecessor, came a burning indignation against the cause of that picturesque emotion. It is indeed a lamentable peculiarity of our fallen nature that the moment of relief from the smart of anxiety is seldom marked by so complete a mental calmness and moderation as could be wished. Ruth rose slowly, with the book still in her hand, and Charles got off his knees as best he could, and stood with one hand on the railing of the balcony, as if to steady himself. His usually pale face was crimson. Ruth closed the book in silence, and with a dreadful precision put it back in its accustomed place. Then she turned and faced him, with the western light full upon her stern face, and another light of contempt and indignation burning in her direct eyes. "Poor little girl," she said in a low, distinct voice. "What a triumph to have succeeded in making her unhappy. She is very young, and she did not understand the rules of the game. Poor, foolish little girl." If he had been red before, he was pale enough now. He drew himself up and met her direct gaze without flinching. He did not speak, and she left him standing in the window, and went slowly along the balcony and down the little staircase into the room below. As she was about to leave the room, he moved forward suddenly and said, Miss Daincourt? Involuntarily, she stopped short, in obedience to the stern authority of the tone. You are unjust. She did not answer, and left the room. End of chapter 17. Chapter 18 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 18.
Uncle John, said Ruth next morning, taking Mr. Alwyn aside after breakfast, we are leaving by the early train, are we not?
No, my love, it is quite impossible. I have several papers to identify and rearrange.
We have stayed a day longer than we intended, as it is. Most of the others go early. Do let us go too.
It is most natural, I am sure, my dear, that you should wish to get home, said Mr. Alwyn, looking with sympathetic concern at his niece. And why your aunt has not forwarded your letters, I can't imagine. But still, if we return by the midday train, Ruth, you will have plenty of time to answer any letters that seem to require immediate attention before the post goes, and I don't see my way to being ready earlier.
Ruth had not even been thinking of Dare and his letters, but she saw that by the early train she was not destined to depart, and watched the other guests take leave with an envious sigh. She was anxious to be gone. The last evening after the episode in the library had been interminably long. Already the morning, though breakfast was hardly over, seemed to have dragged itself out to days in length. A sense of constraint between two people who understand and amuse each other is very galling. Ruth had felt it so. All the previous evening Charles had hardly spoken to her, and had talked mainly to Lady Hope Acton, who was somewhat depressed, and another elder lady. A good night and a flat candlestick can be presented in a very distant manner, and as Ruth received hers from Charles that evening, and met the grave, steady glance that was directed at her, she perceived that he had not forgiven her for what she had said. She felt angry again at the idea that he should venture to treat her with a coldness which seemed to imply that she had been in the wrong. The worst of it was that she felt she was to blame, that she had no right whatever to criticise Charles and his actions. What concerns were they of hers? How much more suitable, how much more eloquent, a dignified silence would have been. She could not imagine now, as she thought it over, why she had been so unreasonably annoyed at the moment as to say what she had done. Yet the reason was not far to seek, if she had only known where to lay hands on it. She was uneasy, impatient. She had longed to get out of the house. And it was still early, only 11. 11 till 12. 12 till 1. 1 till half past. 2 whole hours and a half to be got through, before the Stoke Moreton omnibus would bear her away. She looked round for a refuge during that weary age, and found it nearer than many poor souls do in time of need, namely, at her elbow, in the shape, the welcome shape, of the shy man, almost the only remnant of the large party whose dispersion she had just been watching. Whenever Ruth thought of that shy man afterwards, which was not often, it was with the sincere hope that he had forgotten the forwardness of her behaviour on that particular morning. She wished to see the picture gallery. She would, of all things, like a walk afterwards. No, she had not been as far as the Beech Avenue, but she would like to go. Should they look at the pictures first? Now, no time like the present. How pleased he was, how proud. He felt that his shyness had gone for ever, that Miss Daincourt would no doubt like to hear a few anecdotes of his college life, that a quiet man who does not make himself cheap to start with often wins in the end, that Miss Daincourt had unusual appreciation, not only for pictures, but for reserved and intricate characters that yet—here he ventured on a little joke, and he laughed at it himself—had their lighter side. And in the long picture gallery Ruth and he studied the old masters, as they had seldom been studied before, with an intense and ignorant interest on the one hand, and an entire absence of mind on the other. Charles, who had done a good deal of pacing up and down his room the night before, and had arrived at certain conclusions, passed through the gallery once, but did not stop. He looked grave and preoccupied, and hardly answered a question of Mr. Conway's about one of the pictures. 11:30 at last. A tall inlaid clock in the gallery mentioned the hour by one sedate stroke. The church clock told the village the time of day a second later. They had nearly finished the pictures. Never mind. She could take half an hour to put on her hat, and surely any Beech Avenue, even on a dull day like this, might serve to while away the remaining hour before luncheon.
They had come to the last picture of the Danvers collection, and Ruth was dwelling fondly on a very well-developed cow by Queep, as if she could hardly tear herself away from it, when she heard a step coming up the staircase from the hall, and presently Charles pushed open the carved folding doors which shut off the gallery from the rest of the house, and looked in. She was conscious that he was standing in the doorway, but new beauties in the cow which had hitherto escaped her engaged her whole attention at the moment, and no one can attend to two things at once. Charles did not come any farther, but standing in the doorway he called to the shy man, who went to him, and the two talked together for a few moments. Ruth gazed upon the cow until it became so fixed upon the retina of her eye that when she tried to admire an old Florentine cabinet near it, she still saw its portrait, and when, in desperation, she turned away to look out of the window across the sky and sloping park, the shadow of the cow hung like a portent. A moment later Mr. Conway came hurrying back to her, much perturbed, to say he had quite forgotten till this moment, and not in the least understood, in fact, etc. Danvers' grey cob that he thought of buying was waiting at the door for him to try, in fact had been waiting some time, no idea upon his soul. Ruth cut his apology short before he had done more than flounder well into it. "You must go and try it at once," she said with decision. And then she added, as Charles drew near, "I've changed my mind about going out. It looks as if it might turn to rain. I shall get through some arrears of letter-writing instead." Mr. Conway stammered and repeated himself, and finally rushed out of the gallery. Ruth expected that Charles would accompany him, but he remained standing near the window, apparently engaged like herself in admiring the view. "It struck me," he said slowly, with his eyes half shut, "that Conway proved rather a broken reed just now."
"He did," said Ruth.
She suddenly felt that she could understand what it was in Charles that exasperated Lady Mary so much. He came a step nearer, and his manner altered. "I sent him away," he said, looking gravely at her, "because I wished to speak to you." Ruth did not answer or turn her head, though she felt he was watching her. Her eyes absently followed two young fallow deer in the park, cantering away in a series of hops on their long, stiff legs. "I cannot speak to you here," said Charles, after a pause. Ruth turned round.
"Silence is golden sometimes. I think quite enough has been said already."
"Not by me. You express yourself with considerable frankness. I wish to follow your example."
"You said I was unjust at the time. Surely that was sufficient."
"So insufficient that I am going to repeat it. I tell you again that you are unjust in not being willing to hear what I have to say. I have seen a good deal of harm done by misunderstandings, Miss Dancourt. Pride is generally at the bottom of them. We are both suffering from a slight attack of that malady now. But I value your good opinion too much to hesitate if by any little sacrifice of my own pride I can still retain it. If after your remarks yesterday I can make the effort, and it is an effort, to ask you to hear something I wish to say, you on your side ought not to refuse to listen. It is not a question of liking, you ought not to refuse." He spoke in an authoritative tone, which gave weight to his words, and in spite of herself she saw the truth of what he said. She was one of those rare women who, being convinced against their will, are not of the same opinion still. It was ignominious to have to give way, but after a moment's struggle with herself she surmounted her dislike to being overruled, together with a certain unreasoning tenacity of opinion natural to her sex, and said quietly, "What do you wish me to do?" Charles saw the momentary struggle, and honoured her for a quality which women seldom give men occasion to honour them for. "Do you dislike walking?"
"No."
"Then if you will come out of doors, where there is less likelihood of interruption than in the house, I will wait for you here." She went silently down the picture gallery, half astonished to find herself doing his bidding. She put on her walking things mechanically, and came back in a few minutes to find him standing where she had left him. In silence they went downstairs, and through the piazza with its flowering orange trees, out into the gardens, where on the stone balustrade the peacocks were attitudinizing and conversing in the high key in which they always proclaim a change of weather and their innate vulgarity to the world. Charles led the way towards a little rushing brook which divided the gardens from the park.
"I think you must have had a very low opinion of me beforehand, to say what you did yesterday," he remarked suddenly.
"I was angry," said Ruth. "However true what I said may have been, I had no right to say to a comparative stranger. That is why I repeat that it would be better not to make matters worse by mentioning the subject again. It is sure to annoy us both. Let it rest."
"Not yet," said Charles dryly. "As a comparative stranger, I want to know," stopping and facing her, "exactly what you mean by saying that she, Lady Grace, did not understand the rules of the game."
"I cannot put it in other words," said Ruth,
her courage rising as she felt that a battle was imminent. "Perhaps I can for you. Perhaps you meant to say that you believed I was in the habit of amusing myself at other people's expense, that—I see your difficulty in finding the right words—that it was my evil sport and pastime to, shall we say, raise expectations which it was not my intention to fulfil."
"It is disagreeably put," said Ruth, reddening a little, "but possibly I did mean something of that kind.
And how have you arrived at such an uncharitable opinion of a comparative stranger?" asked Charles, quietly enough, but his light eyes flashing. She did not answer. "You are not a child, to echo the opinion of others," he went on. "You look as if you judged for yourself. What have I done since I met you first, 3 months ago, to justify you in holding me in contempt?"
"I did not say I held you in contempt."
"You must, though, if you think me capable of such meanness." Silence again.
"You have pushed me into saying more than I meant," said Ruth at last. "At least you have said I mean a great deal more than I really do. To be honest, I think you have thoughtlessly given a good deal of pain. I dare say you did it unconsciously."
"Thank you. You are very charitable, but I cannot shield myself under the supposition that at 8:30 I am a creature of impulse, unconscious of the meaning of my own actions."
"If that is the case," thought Ruth, "your behaviour to me has been inexcusable, especially the last few days, though, fortunately for myself, I was not deceived by it."
"If you persist in keeping silence," said Charles, after waiting for her to speak, "any possibility of conversation is at an end."
"I did not come out here for conversation," replied Ruth. "I came, not by my own wish, to hear something you said you particularly desired to say. Do you not think the simplest thing, under the circumstances, would be to say it?"
He gave a short laugh and looked at her in sheer desperation. Did she know what she was pushing him into? "I had forgotten," he said. "It was in my mind all the time, but now you have made it easy for me indeed by coming to my assistance in this way. I will make a fresh start."
He compressed his lips and seemed to pull himself together.
Then he said, in a very level voice, "Kindly give me your whole attention, Miss Daincourt, so that I shall not be obliged to repeat anything. The deer are charming, I know, but you have seen deer before, and will no doubt again. I am sorry that I am obliged to speak to you about myself, but a little autobiography is unavoidable. Perhaps you know that about 3 years ago I succeeded my father. From being penniless and head over ears in debt, I became suddenly a rich man, not by my father's will, who entailed every acre of the estate here and elsewhere on Ralph, and left everything he could to him. I had thought of telling you what my best friends have never known, why I am not still crippled by debt. I had thought of telling you why, at 35, I was still unmarried, for my debts were not the reason. But I will not trouble you with that now. It is enough to say that I found myself in a position which, had I been a little younger, with rather a different past, I should have enjoyed more than I did. I was well received in English society, when, after a lapse of several years and a change of fortune, I returned to it. If I had thought I was well received for myself, I should have been a fool. But I came back disillusioned. I saw the machinery. When you reflect on the vast and intricate machinery employed by mothers with grown-up daughters, you may imagine what I saw. In all honesty and sincerity, I wished to marry. But in the ease with which I saw I could do so, lay my chief difficulty. I did not want a new toy, but a companion. I suppose I still clung to one last illusion, that I might meet a woman whom I could love, and who would love me, and not my name or income. I could not find her, but I still believed in her. I went everywhere in the hope of meeting her, and if others have ever been disappointed in me,
they have never known how disappointed I have been in them. For 3 years I looked for her everywhere, but I could not find her, and at last I gave her up. And then I met Lady Grace Lawrence, and liked her. I had reason to believe she could be disinterested. She came of good people. All Lawrences are good. She was simple and unspoiled, and she seemed to like me. When I look back, I believe that I had decided to ask her to marry me, and that it was only by the merest chance that I left London without speaking to her. What prevented me, I hardly know, unless it was a reluctance at the last moment to cast the die. I came down to Atherston, harassed and anxious, tired of everything and everybody. And there, said Charles with sudden passion, turning and looking full at Ruth, there I met you. The blood rushed to her face, and she hastily interposed. I don't see any necessity to bring my name in. Perhaps not, he returned, recovering himself instantly. Unfortunately, I do. You expect too much of my vanity, said Ruth, her voice trembling a little. But in this instance, I don't think you can turn it to account. I beg you will leave me out of the question. I am sorry, I cannot oblige you, he said grimly. You can't be left out. I only regret that you dislike being mentioned, because that is a mere nothing to what is coming. She trusted that he did not perceive that the reason she made no reply was because she suddenly felt unable to articulate. Her heart was beating wildly, as that gentle, well-conducted organ had never beaten before. What was coming? Could this stern, determined man be the same apathetic, sarcastic being whom she had hitherto known? From that time, he continued, I became surer and surer of what at first I hardly dared to hope, what it seemed presumption in me to hope, namely, that at last I had found what I had looked for in vain so long. I had to keep my engagement with the Hope Actons in Scotland, but I regretted it. I stayed as short a time as I could. I did not ask them to come here. They offered themselves. I think, if I have been to blame, it has not been in so heartless a manner as you supposed, and it appears to me Lady Hope Acton should not have come. This is my explanation. You can have the rest for yourself. Have I said enough to soften your harsh judgment of yesterday? Ruth could not speak. The trees were behaving in the most curious manner, were whirling round, were swaying up and down. The beeches close in front were dancing quadrilles, now ranged in two long rows, now setting to partners, now hurrying back to their places as she drew near. "Sit down," said Charles's voice gently. "You look tired." The trunk of a fallen tree suddenly appeared rising up to meet her out of a slight mist, and she sat down on it more precipitately than she could have wished. In a few seconds the trees returned to their places, and the mist, which appeared to be very local, cleared away. Charles was sitting on the trunk beside her, looking at her intently. The anger had gone out of his face, and had given place to a look of deep anxiety and suspense. "I have not finished yet," he said, and his voice had changed as much as his face. "There is still something more."
"No, no," said Ruth. "At least, if there is, don't say it."
"I think I would rather say it. You wish to save me pain, I see, but I am quite prepared for what you are going to say. I did not intend to speak to you on the subject for a long time to come, but yesterday's event has forced my hand. There must be no more misunderstandings between us. You intend to refuse me, I can see. All the same, I wish to tell you that I love you, and to ask you to be my wife."
"I'm afraid I cannot," said Ruth, almost inaudibly.
"No," said Charles, looking straight before him. "I have asked you too soon. You are quite right. I did not expect anything different. I only wished you to know. But perhaps some day—"
"Don't,"
said Ruth, clasping her hands tightly together. "You don't know what you are saying. Nothing can make any difference, because I am engaged." She dared not look at his face, but she saw his hand clinch. For an age neither spoke. Then he turned his head slowly and looked at her. His face was grey, even to the lips. With a strange, swift pang at the heart, she saw how her few words had changed it.
"To whom?"
he said at last, hardly above a whisper.
"To Mr. Dare."
"Not that man who has come to live at Vanden?"
"Yes."
Another long silence.
When was it?
10 days ago.
10 days ago, repeated Charles mechanically, and his face worked.
10 days ago.
It is not given out yet, said Ruth, hesitating, because Mr. Alwyn does not wish it during Lord Polesworth's absence. I never thought of any mistake being caused by not mentioning it. I would not have come here if I had had the least idea that—
You cannot mean to say that you had never seen that what I felt for you?
Indeed, I never thought of such a thing until 2 minutes before you said it. I'm very sorry I did not, but I imagined—
Let me hear what you imagined.
I noticed you talked to me a good deal, but I thought you did exactly the same to Lady Grace and others.
You could not imagine that I talked to others, to any woman in the world, as I did to you.
I supposed, said Ruth simply, that you talked gaily to Lady Grace because it suited her, and more gravely to me, because I am naturally grave.
I thought at the time you were rather clever in adapting yourself to different people so easily, and I was glad that I understood your manner better than some of the others.
Better, said Charles bitterly.
Better, when you thought that of me. No, you do not need to say anything. I was in fault, not you. I don't know what right I had to imagine you understood me. You seemed to understand me, to fancy that we had anything in common, that in time—
He broke into a low, wretched laugh.
And all the while you were engaged to another man. Good God, what a farce! What a miserable mistake from first to last!
Ruth said nothing. It was indeed a miserable mistake.
He rose wearily to his feet. I was forgetting, he said. It is time to go home.
And they went back together in silence, which was more bearable than speech just then.
The peacocks were still pirouetting and minuetting on the stone balustrade as they came back to the garden. The gong began to sound as they entered the piazza. To Ruth, it was a dreadful meal. She tried to listen to Mr. Conway's account of the grey cob, or to the placid conversation of Mr. Alwyn about the beloved manuscripts. Fortunately, the morning papers were full of a recent forgery in America and a murder in London, which furnished topics when these were exhausted, and Charles used them to the utmost. At last the carriage came. Mr. Alwyn and Mr. Conway simultaneously broke into incoherent ejaculations respecting the pleasure of their visit. Ruth's hand met Charles's for an embarrassed second, and a moment later they were whirling down the straight, wide approach between the columns of fantastically clipped hollies, leaving Charles standing in the doorway. He was still standing there when the carriage rolled under the arched gateway with its rampant stone lions. Ruth glanced back once as they turned into the road, at the stately old house with its pointed gables and forests of chimneys cutting the grey skyline. She saw the owner turn slowly and go up the steps, and looked hastily away again. "Poor Danvers," said Mr. Alwyn cheerfully, also looking and putting Ruth's thoughts into words. "He must be desperately lonely at that house all by himself, but I suppose he is not often there." And Mr. Alwyn, whose mind had been entirely relieved since Ruth's engagement from the dark suspicion he had once harboured respecting Charles, proceeded to dilate upon the merits of the charters and of the owner of the charters, until he began to think Ruth had a headache, and finding it to be the case, talked no more till they reached, at the end of their little journey, the door of Slumberley Rectory.
"Is it very bad?" he asked kindly, as he helped her out of the carriage. Ruth assented, fortunately with some faint vestige of truth, for her hat hurt her forehead. "Then run up straight to your own room, and I will tell your aunt that you will come and have a chat with her later on, perhaps after tea, when the post will be gone."
Mr. Alwyn spoke in the whisper of stratagem. Ruth was only too thankful to be allowed to slip on tiptoe to her own room, but she had not been there many minutes when a tap came to the door. "There, my dear," said Mr. Alwyn, putting his head in and holding some letters towards her. "Your aunt ought to have forwarded them. I brought them up here at once, and there is nearly an hour to post-time, and she won't expect you to come down till then. I think the headache will be better now, eh?"
He nodded kindly to her and closed the door again. Ruth sat down mechanically and began to sort the packet he had put into her hands. The first three letters were in the same handwriting, Dare's large, vague handwriting,
that ran from one end of the envelope to the other, and partly hid itself under the stamp. She looked at them, but did not open them. A feeling of intense lassitude and fatigue had succeeded to the unconscious excitement of the morning. She could not read them now. They must wait with the others. Presently she could feel an interest in them. Not now. She leaned her head upon her hand, and a rush of pity swept away every other feeling as she recalled that last look at Stoke Moreton, and how Charles had turned so slowly and wearily to go indoors. There was an ache at her heart as she thought of him, a sense of regret and loss. And he had loved her all the time.
"If I'd only known," she said to herself,
pressing her hands against her forehead.
"But how could I tell? How could I tell?"
She raised her head with a sudden movement, and began with nervous fingers to open Dare's letters, and read them carefully. End of chapter 18.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.